Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hello, and welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. 888-914-9149. That's the number to call. As you know, if you're a regular, you probably have that on speed dial. 888-914-9149. Now, I had an email, as we tend to do. We have emails that come in that are sort of like going back to earlier comments that I made on the program, or answers that I gave, or comments that somebody else made on the program. So that's fine. I don't mind doing that at all. This one comes in from Dennis in Chicago, and he says, last week I ran a red light. My hurry was to get from Chicago to the suburbs to meet friends for dinner. The next day I felt guilty about it, but was unsure about going to confession for this. It was weighing on me, so I went to my go-to spiritual director, whose name is Mr. Google. Sure enough, typing, quote, is running a red light sinful, end quote, in my Google search led me to Relevant Radio, which had an article on this very question, and the article mentioned your response as a caller on your show asked this question too. He says, so, excuse me. Sounds like I'm getting choked up, but I'm really not.
Yeah, this isn't that sad of a story.
This feels like a Monday morning. All right, let me see if I can get this. So he says, I went to confession, and I felt relieved that I went. Thank you. Well, Dennis, thank you. I appreciate that very much. It's good to know that, and I'm guessing you probably didn't know about Relevant Radio before you Googled it. So I'm glad that Google brought you to us and vice versa.
I've never heard of that before. That's a new one.
Google is your friend.
Yeah.
That should be a t-shirt that everybody can wear. Google is your friend. So, Cyrus, you were kind enough to unarchive the audio from that call from, I don't know how long ago that was. Was that a year or two ago?
Yeah, it was
like
at least a year ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So do you want to play that? So that'll give not only Dennis, but also give everyone else listening.
It'll give you a chance to catch her. You got to lay off the Marlboros.
No, I took a sip of coffee and it went down the wrong pipe.
Uh-oh. Well,
it's devastating when you're trying to talk on national radio. Maybe that means I shouldn't drink coffee.
I love it.
I know
All right,
you do.
So here is that call.
This is going out to you, Dennis, in Chicago. Here you go. Let's go to Sal now in California. Hi, Sal.
Hey, Patrick. I have a question. So I'm driving my kids to school today. I've got three daughters, 11 and okay. two twin seven. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did the usual rush to get through a yellow light to not get stopped by the red. And right mm-hmm. in the middle of the intersection, I got a red.
Yeah.
So my 11's right in front. She says, Dad, I think you just threw a red light. I said, yeah. He said, is that a sin?
Mm-hmm. I said, so let's look at that. Okay. First of all, being a native Californian, I got my driver's license when I was 16 in the state of California. And as I recall, as long as you are into the intersection and you're in the intersection when the light is still amber, it's technically not a red light. Now, I think that's a judgment call on the part of the police. It's not a good idea. But I think technically you have to be still outside the intersection when the light turns red. But that's a technicality. I would tell you, Sal, I think it probably is sinful, especially if you have children in the car and you're putting their lives at risk. That would be a sin. It would be a sin against the fifth commandment. And the fifth commandment does not only mean thou shalt not kill an innocent person. It also can refer to sins where you're reckless and you endanger your life or the lives of other people for no good reason. So if you're in the habit of running red lights, I would say, yeah, that probably is a sin. And now that you know, maybe you never thought of it that way before, but now that you realize that just risking your life and the lives of your children unnecessarily, that does involve some sin. Hopefully that'll be an incentive to stop running red lights.
Yeah, I just thought dishonesty would be the sin part, but I guess you clarified that. Thank you.
You're welcome, Sal. Drive safe, okay? You've got precious cargo. We need those kids around. And we need you around for a good long time as well. So drive the speed limit. Don't run any red lights. and live to tell about it. You know, this is weird. This is serendipity, Cyrus. You notice my voice is sounding better. It didn't sound too good in that clip either. It sounded like maybe I had just had a sip of coffee before I took that guy's phone call. I was like, what is this? I thought it would be better if we played the... So there it is as far as my thoughts on that. Now, those are just my thoughts. I can tell you the Catholic Church does not have a teaching that says in the catechism, if you run a red light, you've committed a sin. Obviously, you're not going to find that. But as a matter of principle, this, I think, is a useful thing for you and for me, just in life in general, as you're navigating through life, sometimes choppy waters and things happen or things could happen and you're trying to figure out, would this be a sin? Not that I'm in any way suggesting that you should live in fear or be constantly morbidly consumed with anxiety about sin. No, I'm not suggesting that at all. But rather to just be aware that some things in life that could be sinful, I'm thinking many people probably don't even, it doesn't even register with them. Like the OMG conversation we had the other day, Cyrus, remember that? OMG and all the derivations of taking the Lord's name in vain. I think most people, they just never really think about that. So for them, it just goes right over the top and it doesn't even occur to them, maybe there is something wrong with this.
Yeah, I know what you mean. My kids will, they'll use some slang that is just, it's like on the fence of,
yeah,
is this good or bad? And so I try to tell them, like, guys, this, try to find different words for what you're saying. Right. Because when you use these base words, it kind of makes you look ignorant.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. How did they react to that?
Oh, dad. Well, what they do, we watched a lot of Brady Bunch, and whenever I start going into a speech, they start pretending they're the Brady Bunch kids, and I'm just giving the regular Brady Bunch dad speech, and it means nothing to them. One ear in, one ear out the other.
Well, keep doing it though. Keep doing that. I think it would be helpful. Now, it's interesting. So we had the kind of return to the question about running a red light. Would that be sinful? And once again, for the record, I think it would be sinful if you're, I mean, obviously, if it's unintentional, that's different. Things happen. You're driving. You might get distracted. You didn't intend to do it. But if you're thinking, yeah, nobody's around, I can run this light, that's a bad idea. Not only because you yourself could die, somebody else could die. And all the more so if you have children in the car. You have to protect them. I already talked about that. But here's another one, Cyrus. It's interesting that things come full circle. Back to that stray cat. Remember that question that we got a week or two ago? Is it a sin to stop feeding a stray cat? That captured the imagination of a bunch of people. I never thought it would. So let's see. Another Chicago listener, this is Paul. He wrote in to say, the gentleman called and asked if it was a sin not to feed a stray cat. And I agree with you, it isn't a sin not to feed the stray cat. But I do believe there is a somewhat moral responsibility to feed or help the cat or dog to find the owner or take it to a vet to see if it's chipped. There are several organizations that help these animals whose owners have lost them or neglected them. He mentions recalling how St. Francis of Assisi treated animals. He said, I have two rescue cats. I would also like a dog, but I'm not home enough. Anyway, just my thought. It says, I love your show and Father Simon's show too. Thanks, Paul. As I'm sure Father Simon would concur with me. Well, this to me seems like a fine line, and I don't know where that line is exactly. Personally, if you would just stop me on the street and said, you know, held a microphone up to my face and said, we're doing some interviews, man on the street. Do you think that you have a moral responsibility to feed a stray cat or to help find the owner or to take the cat to a vet to see if it's chipped? I'm going to give you the honest truth. I would almost certainly say no. I would almost certainly say no. I don't have a moral responsibility to do that. I think it's a good idea if you can do that. And for those who are maybe have more time and opportunity, especially if it's a cat that could be their neighbors or something, it's a nice thing to do. So it seems that the line would not be that you have a moral responsibility to do it, but rather what a great person you are if you did do it. But if you didn't do that and you just shut your door and didn't allow any food to go out on your back patio so as to shoo the stray cat away, who will get the idea and realize, well, there's no food here, I'm going to move on. I don't think you're doing anything wrong. I really don't. I think it's nice if you do something, but it's not bad or immoral if you don't do something. Now, that's my take. Cyrus, what is your take on that?
I was just thinking of my wife and I, when we do something nice, you know, just mm-hmm. because it's the right, you know, it's the right thing to do. It's the nice thing to do. There's an episode of Seinfeld where Jerry's saying, you know, my mom was right about me when he does something nice. And so that's what we'll say to each other.
My mom was right. Oh, yeah. In other words, what a great boy.
Yeah, well, I'm a good boy. My mom was right about me.
Yeah. Yeah, when you feel good about yourself because you did something nice. I suppose that's one of the nice side benefits of that. But I'm thinking about what Jesus said to extend that a little bit further, that if you do it for the applause or if you do it for adulation and people thinking well of you, well, you kind of already have your reward. Mm-hmm. But if you're kind and generous and nobody is applauding you, maybe because you're doing it in an anonymous kind of way, that's a much better way to do it, he says, because then you're laying up treasure in heaven. But the people who do it for the applause, they already have the reward. I think about that.
Yeah.
Were you a good boy growing up, Cyrus, or were you in trouble a lot?
For my circumstances, I was very good. I think, I could have been very, very bad. I mm-hmm. basically had the run of the town when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got caught sneaking, just to show what kind of parental supervision I had. I got caught sneaking into my house when I was probably like 14. I was halfway.
At what time of night was
probably,
that?
It was probably 11. It wasn't even, I mean, for me, it wasn't that late. And so I'm literally halfway in and out
of the
window.
Did a squad car roll up and then the police?
No, my mom flipped on the light, and I look at her dumbfounded. I'm literally halfway in the window. And she's like, why don't you just use the front door? And then she turned off the light and went back.
So she was not bothered by it.
She didn't care. Huh. Uh-huh. So well, I could have been out causing all kinds of problems, but I was playing video games and hanging out with friends. Mm-hmm. We were very harmless.
So how much of that do you import into your parenting of your kids now? A couple of whom I guess are teenagers. Do you, any lessons learned from your own lack of supervision? I mean, do you like overdo it now with your kids, or do you hang on loosely with them, or
no,
what's your parental
philosophy? That's a really tough question, and I think it depends a lot on how the kid behaves. So I guess I don't treat them all equally because they are different people with they sway one way or the other, and so I have to be conscious of that when I'm setting boundaries.
Do you ever tell any of them, you're my favorite? Don't tell the other ones, but you're my favorite.
I cannot answer that question because I don't know which one of them is listening.
Well, if you'd say the same thing to all of them, then they all can be equally happy or hurt. No, that's one of those things that I've known people whose parents have said that to their kids. It's devastating and very, very counterproductive, if you ask me.
Well, I think if it's done in a joke, you know, it's
that's different.
Yeah,
yeah.
But you don't want to take a kid aside and be like, you know what, you really are my favorite.
I know, but some people do that.
Yeah, that's probably not the best idea.
Oh, I hate that. I absolutely hate it. And I'm being serious. There have been times when my kids will jokingly say, "Oh, well, this one here is your favorite." And Nancy and I say, absolutely not. We love all of you just the same. And we, you know, we love you no matter what. Sometimes you please us more than other times.
That's a fact.
That might be what you're thinking about.
I have told the kids that I love them. I was like, I love you more than anyone is ever going to love you. Like, so when I'm disciplining them or telling them they can't do something, it's like, it's out of love. It's not because I'm not trying to keep you from having fun.
Yeah.
It's because I love you and you should listen to me.
Yeah, I mean that's the honest truth of it, is that your mom and dad, they and I'm speaking sort of you rhetorically here, just in general. Your mom and dad, if they're doing their job right, they love you for who you are, and that's not going to change no matter what you do. They're still going to love you. They'll always love you. They will disapprove at times of things you do or decisions that you make, but that's their prerogative because their duty before God is to try to help you become the good person that God wants you to be. But there is always going to, there will always be that level of parent-child relationship. It never goes away. It's weird. I mean, I'm in my 60s. My dad is in his mid-80s, and I still relate to him as his son. And I don't think that's anything unusual, but it's not as though that dynamic has changed. We're just older, you know, grayer. And when I was a kid, I remember thinking, well, when I grow up, I'm going to be, you know, I'm my own man. I'll make my own decisions. And that's true. But at the same time, I guess I had this puerile notion that when I grew up and I was calling all my own shots, that I wouldn't have to listen to my dad or care about what he thought about anything. I could just do it the way I wanted to do it. And he can be quiet for all I was concerned. And I found out how really different life really is. You know, the value in a parent who's been down the road a lot further than you have. More gray in his hair, more experience, more perspective. To me, that's huge, perspective. You can see things, as you know, Cyrus, that your kids just can't see because they don't have the perspective that you do now that you're, should I say how old you are? Now that you are a man of a certain age.
Well, yeah, my kids are getting older. I hope. It's such a hard thing being a parent sometimes because you want to I want to provide for my kids. I want to have. I've given them a life that I never had.
Yeah.
But so they've had a completely different experience than I have, and which is what I wanted. But at the same time, they're looking at life in a way that is harder for me to comprehend because they've lived a completely different life than I've lived.
Right. So like you were wearing zoot suits when you were younger, and they don't have zoot suits. You don't let them wear those, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking of.
With your cane and top hat, jauntily going down the boulevard on your merry way.
I look pretty good in that.
Give it a try.
All right, I will.
I'll put that picture on Twitter in a red hot flash. I promise you that. If you send me that picture, I'll put it on there. 888-914-9149. Quick time out. We're going to come back to your phone calls. We also have tonnage of emails. We're going to try to get through as many of those as possible. The number again, 888-914-9149. I will be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code PATRICK for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com.
Heck yeah, the Patrick Madrid Show is flipping sweet!
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio. If you need
a friend, I have this sudden urge to play tetherball. Where did that come from?
Lucky.
Yeah. 888, and let me start over, 888-914-9149. We'll start with Anthony in Odessa, Florida. Good morning, Anthony.
Good morning, Patrick. So here's the deal. I'll make it quick and short. Me and my dad are both Catholics. He just had a sort of reawakening in his faith, and it was propelled by his discovery of the Latin Mass and tradition. And I'm a traditional Catholic, so I like that and I encourage that. Uh-huh. But he's gone to the point where he likes it so much, loves it, that he rejects anything besides it. And I always said it's okay to favor the Latin Mass and tradition, but you shouldn't throw out the rest. And the other day he went so far to say that Novus Ordo is invalid, which is implying that transubstantiation doesn't occur and doubting the real presence. And I tried telling him how grave of a sin this is, and you're implying that the church can prescribe a false mass, you know, which denies that the Holy Spirit is with the church, that hell has prevailed against the church, you know? And I would just like your advice on it. Are we allowed to have beliefs like this, or is it grave sin, or is it not?
Yeah, it's definitely a grave sin, objectively speaking, but is it formally a grave sin on his part? In other words, is he formally culpable of this because he may be simply ignorant and he doesn't realize what this entails? So that, of course, I don't know. But from a formal standpoint, sure, what he's doing is he's denying something that the church has officially taught, and that is that this new rite of the Mass is valid. Now, I remember as a child when the Mass changed. So I was maybe 6 or 7 years old when it actually changed from the traditional Mass to the Novus Ordo. So I only have a child's memory of it. But I did have the kind of fluky bit of good luck that I was going to grammar school at the Mission San Juan Capistrano in Southern California. And the old mission parish had an indult from Pope Paul VI to continue celebrating the traditional Mass and the sacraments in the traditional form. And so even though I was alive and you know, as an altar boy, etc., during the time after the change of the Mass, I had the great good fortune of being able to serve Mass there at Mission San Juan Capistrano. So it helped form my consciousness in ways that I didn't fully understand at the time. And I'm leading up to an answer to your question, Anthony. But on the weekends, we would go to our local parish, and it was super happy clappy. Guitars, felt banners, like the worst of the 1970s that you can imagine. It was bad, looking back on it. And then during the week, I was serving at the traditional Latin Mass in the Sarah Chapel. So I grew up with this unusual kind of simultaneous foot in both worlds. And what it did for me is it helped me to see that in spite of maybe aesthetic superiority on the part of the traditional Latin Mass, or the clarity and the power of the prayers, the richness that's there, and in some ways the lack thereof, at least the way the Mass was being celebrated at my local parish, nonetheless, the Mass is the Mass is the Mass. It's the same once-for-all sacrifice of Christ on the cross that is represented to us in time in the Mass. And it's hard for me to kind of put into words, but when that crystallized in my mind and I realized that the Mass and the reality of the Mass and the validity of the Mass transcends the aesthetics, that helped me an awful lot. And even though the new Mass does not suit my aesthetic in the way that the traditional Latin Mass does, I have no qualms whatsoever about attending the new rite of the Mass, because I know that it is indeed valid. Now, how do I know that? Well, a few things you could say maybe to your father. I mean, one thing that might have come to my mind, although I don't think I would have dared said it to my father, would be, Dad, when did you become Pope? I didn't know that you were Pope, and you're now calling the shots and deciding what the church can and can't do and what the church can and can't say. Now, that line of questioning will ultimately lead Anthony into either he will have to somehow try to modify or attenuate his view on this issue, or he would go down the road of what's called sedevacantism, which I'm sure you're probably already familiar with. This idea, well, there was no true pope during Vatican II. John the 23rd was not a valid pope. Paul the 6th was not a valid pope, and the popes after them have not been valid popes. Therefore, their changes were null and void. And this so-called new Mass, they'll say, is invalid on the face of it. We should return to the traditional Latin Mass. That's a dead-end street. And that gets even further into what you're talking about, Dad. You're then saying that the church can defect, that the church can be without a shepherd for some very extended period of time. So that would be the state of a conscious position. Rather, what I would say to him is, Dad, the first Mass was not said in Latin. Jesus did not celebrate the first Mass at the Last Supper with ornate vestments and Latin and polyphony, Gregorian chant. There were no statues or candles or any of the things that we associate with the traditional Latin Mass, but that was the Mass. Indeed, in the early centuries of the church, scholars of antiquity and those who have studied the historical dimensions of the church's liturgy, they show that for the first, at least in the East anyway, for the first few centuries, the Mass was in Greek. And it had certain forms that would be similar but not the same as the traditional Latin Mass. So the traditional Latin Mass that you and I know and love, and I do love it, I do esteem it, it was codified by Pope Pius V. And this was around the time of the Reformation. It was an effort to kind of rein in all of the different versions of the Mass that had proliferated. And in some cases, there were even what appear to be some aberrations or exaggerations. And so the Pope, in his wisdom, wanted to make this a uniform, regulated form of the Mass that would be celebrated everywhere in the Latin Rite. And so it was until the Second Vatican Council. But my point here is that the Pope had the authority to impose this rite of the Mass on the Church. And the other rites of the Mass that were abrogated or suppressed, he had the right to do that. Now, I'm not arguing, Anthony, and please don't misunderstand me here. I'm not in any way arguing for, because I do not support the idea of abrogating or abolishing the traditional Latin Mass. That's not the direction I'm heading in. Rather, what I'm saying is that the Pope has the authority as Pope to modify as he sees beneficial. Sometimes popes get things wrong. And you look back later and you say, whoopsie, that was a mistake. Shouldn't have done that. But it doesn't impinge upon the fact that the Pope has an authority that he's competent to use in these matters. So last thought, and then I'll throw it back to you, is all of the above being said, we have a new rite of the Mass that, objectively speaking, seems in some ways inferior to the traditional Latin Mass. And we also have, as part of it, a new impulse for disunity and division. You may say, what? Well, because the traditional Latin Mass, as you know, was celebrated all around the world in Latin. And everybody, anywhere in the world, could go to Mass, and they would all be saying the same prayers, and they could all be following everything in the Missal. And of course, now that the new rite of the Mass has been promulgated and the vernacular has taken hold, it has, oddly enough, introduced a real disunity into the body of Christ, because now you have people who can't share the Mass together the way they once could. So these are some of the effects of the Church's change on the Mass, but we should not be in any way tempted, as your father sadly is, to say, well, then the Church has failed, and the Church has taught in essence would be grave heresy to promote and promulgate a rite of the Mass that is so defective as to be invalid. That is the height of the Church failing, and Christ said the Church would not fail. So whether we like the new Mass or we don't like it, or we don't like it as much as the old Mass, those things are in a way immaterial, because our opinions are beside the point. Our aesthetic tastes are beside the point. The question is the Mass, is it valid? Is the Church capable of foundering and failing on such an important and central matter? I, as a Catholic, say absolutely not. So personally, I'm just going to stay the course, stay with Jesus, be a loyal son of the Church. I have my likes and my dislikes, but that's between me and God. But I want to be faithful to the Church and press on. And I think that's the message, however you can deliver that for your father, I think that's the message he needs to hear. Otherwise, before you know it, he will wind up as a Sede Vacantist, and he will be his own Pope. And he'll be the one determining what is acceptable and not acceptable. And of course, that's not his job. So those are some thoughts off the cuff, Anthony. Any follow-up?
Thank you. I think you answered that perfectly, and I'm going to relay those points to him. I think he just hasn't heard enough to oppose his belief yet, and if he does, then he'll eventually get away from it. He might be experiencing growing pains because he is pretty new to tradition, and he's always been a Catholic, but he hasn't had the enthusiasm until he fell in love with this traditional world of it, and I understand that.
Me too. But, and I'm with him on that. I'm empathetic to his position on this, because I share and appreciate his love for the traditional Mass. It is beautiful. It is powerful. There's no question about
it. You get head over heels over it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But here's the thing. We can never allow our love and esteem for this precious patrimony of the Church to blind us to the fact that, even though that may be the case, we still owe allegiance and obedience to the church. And we can never put ourselves in a position of being the arbiters of what is going to be considered authentically Catholic and what is not. We can have our likes and dislikes, but that's the church's role, the magisterium's role, to make those decisions. And if we're going to be really Catholic, we have to be faithful to the church. And this is the irony of it, Anthony. I'll leave you with this thought. How ironic in a terrible way it would be for somebody to be so in love with the traditional Mass, as so many people are, to the point where it would actually take them out of the Catholic Church. And they would wind up rendering themselves non-Catholic out of love for the Mass that is exaggerated and carries them out of the church. What a strange irony that would be.
Right. Yeah, that's tragic. But I always go back to the Gospels, and that's what grounds me. Where I go, did Christ say that the gates of hell will never prevail against the church? He did. So this has to be the Pope, the rightful Pope. I have every reason to trust him, his authority. And did Christ say that whatever is bound on earth is bound in heaven? He did. So I have to trust that judgment, you know, and that's what keeps me grounded, you know, and checks my pride and my arrogance. And I'm thankful for that. And I hope he comes around to it also.
Well, I mean, he's your father, and I know you love him and you honor him. So the fact that you're being careful and wanting to approach him in a way that is respectful, I admire that, and I encourage you to continue doing that. Obviously, you don't want to just, you know, do a Mexican hat dance on your dad's opinion on this because he's your father. But at the same time, with the kind of gentle persuasion and good example on your part, that may be helpful to him. One thing to remember, Anthony, and this might give him some solace, and that is that if you go back just a few years, Pope Benedict XVI issued his motu proprio, Summorum Pontificum, in which he said, I want the traditional Latin Mass as available as widely as possible. I encourage parishes to have it. Add it to your Sunday Mass, roster of Masses. So he was providing the church an opportunity and a structure so that the traditional Mass could be available as widely as possible for those who desire it. And that's a great number of people. Well, Pope Francis, he did a 180. And with his motu proprio, he, in essence, reversed and abrogated, in essence, certainly in the spirit of things, everything that Pope Benedict said he wanted. So this is the weird thing about all this. It's entirely possible, and some might say it's probable. I don't know. Only God knows. But it's entirely possible that the next pope or the pope after that will completely reverse everything Pope Francis has done and issue his motu proprio and say, nope, we're not doing that anymore. The traditional Latin Mass is going to be available as widely as possible, and I want bishops to make it available. He could even go beyond what Pope Benedict did. Now, there is a bit of a whiplash effect here, to be sure. But the fact that Pope Francis made his decision the way he did, reversing what Pope Benedict said, is sufficient evidence to show that maybe like a pendulum, things may indeed swing back in the other direction. And I wouldn't be surprised if they did. Only God knows. But I don't want your father to feel like all hope is lost, you know, that this is something that will never be present in the church. I think just let's play the long game and see how things go. And people might be surprised. I have to leave it at that, though, Anthony. Thank you. I'm going to take a break, and I'll be right back. Pray for the Pope, any given Pope at any given time. Pray for the Pope. Ask the Lord to make him be the best Pope possible. Give him clarity of mind and courage of conviction so that he can do the right thing under these difficult circumstances. And that's for any Pope, including Pope Francis. But never forget that. Always pray for the Pope every day. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Real life solutions you can believe in. Yeah! The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah! We're going to California, we're going to South Dakota, and Texas, and New York, and Texas, and New York. Yeah!
We're going everywhere. Where else are we going?
And Oregon and Washington. Oregon and Washington.
Yeah.
We're going to South Dakota. We're going to South Dakota and Michigan. And
that's
Michigan.
That's right.
Yeah! Yeah! And then we're going to Washington, D.C.
What a gift Howard Dean has been for this show. And whoever came up with that song, too. What a gift. Thank you. Let's go to the phones. Georgia in Plainfield, Illinois. I almost said Georgia in Georgia. Welcome, Georgia.
Hi, Patrick. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
I had a question about how, like, what your opinions are on how the cell phone and, like, access to the internet affects young Catholics.
Oh, talk about a softball question. Ready for me to hit that out of the park?
Oh, I'm ready.
All right. How old are you, by the way, if you don't mind my asking? You sound like a young woman.
I'm 20.
You're 20. Yeah. Okay, so there you go. All right. I think I'll start at the top and work my way down. I think that parents who give their children smartphones, which is different in my view from a dumb phone where you can make phone calls, you can get phone calls, you can text, but that's all you can do. I'm not talking about those kinds of phones. A smartphone, Android, iPhone connected to the internet, apps, etc. It's like handing your child a stick of dynamite and assuming it and hoping that it won't go off. And it will go off eventually. It's going to go mm-hmm. off. So I think it is the height of folly. I'm trying to choose my words here because I want to be respectful, but I think it's the height of folly for a parent to give his child, and I mean children, like under the age of teenagerhood, but even mm-hmm. younger teenagers. I think it's very bad. So I'll start there. How is it changing people? Well, you probably know this a lot better than I do, Georgia. I'm more of a spectator, but in your world, I'm sure your peers and people maybe a little bit older than you and a little bit younger than you, isn't it true that you're always, maybe not you, but isn't it true that your peer group is always on their phones? They're always on TikTok or they're always on Instagram or Snapchat or whatever the popular apps of the day are. They're doing that all the time. And my impression, tell me if I'm wrong, but my impression is that young people have forgotten how to get together and just hang out without their phones. They have forgotten how to have conversations. They've forgotten how to just enjoy pastimes, like, you know, whatever it may be. Like, even dancing was really popular when my parents were in high school, and it was still popular when I was in high school. But when do you ever hear about kids getting together and doing something like that? I never hear about that. So I think that the net effect of these wonderful, terrible gadgets that we have, I have one, everybody has one, is that they absorb so much of our time and attention that they have shaped us now to looking at the world, but also looking at each other in a very different artificial way. There's so much more distance now between people. And the phone is used for mostly more things than making a phone call. It's all the other things that are on the phone that people are absorbed in. So it's addictive, it's wonderful, it's terrible, it's invasive, it's a fantastic tool. I can say a lot of good about it. A lot of my life runs on my cell phone in terms of email and other things that kind of help regulate my day. So I'm grateful for those tools. But I'm also really concerned about the way in which this is just a time suck and people just go down that rabbit hole. And in some cases, some bad things can happen to them. So that's just a shotgun blast of ideas right off the top. What do you think?
Oh, I agree with you completely. I think that, like, especially dating is difficult. And, like, if you have, like, any, like, thoughts about dating, because I feel like we're always talking to more than one person on the phone. So it kind of gets confusing for young people.
For sure. I mean, are you talking about like dating apps like Tinder, which is not really a dating app, it's a you-know-what app, but Tinder, things like that? Or do you mean more like a dating website?
No, I mean, just like you have, like, my girlfriends have contact with like 2 to 3 guys at the same time. And it's like, who are you really interested in or who's interested in you kind of a thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this actually leads to another interesting angle here, Georgia, and that is one of the side effects I see of, well, the phone is part of a bigger picture. Look at the way movies and television programs and videos are made. You'll notice that it's just really short, quick glimpses of things that quickly cut to the next thing, to the next thing, to the next thing, to the next thing. And we see this in movies too, where unlike movies from before, let's say Orson Welles or other movie makers, you'd have these long extended scenes with dialogue and the camera would be focused on a particular thing. They don't do it that way anymore, because I think one of the side effects, and the phone has contributed to this, is that we are so fragmented now in our attention span, and we're so accustomed to receiving information in little bursts, little even subliminal bursts, that we're not fully aware of what we're actually seeing and how it's affecting our subconscious, that I think now people have a difficult time with any kind of extended project like reading a book or doing something that's not constantly bombarding them with stimuli.
Fact.
That's another side effect. And I think the smartphones have contributed to that, just because you can quickly switch from one thing to the other, to the other, to the other, to the other, talk to three people at the same time. It's really weird how it's rewiring our minds, but I see it happening. What are you seeing in your peer group?
I definitely think, like, I can't remember a time where I hung out with a group of friends without all of us looking down at our phones at some point. And like a lack of attention and what's going on. And like, I don't know if we really necessarily feel that, or if it just feels so normal, like just have a lack of attention from your peers.
Mm-hmm. Could you get together with four or five of your friends and not have your phones out, using your phones if you're sitting around a table in a restaurant or something? Or would everybody have his phone out, so you're talking and texting and talking and whatever? I'm guessing it's more the latter, right?
Yeah, it's probably more the latter.
I've heard people say that one way to round that is they'll say, okay, everybody put your phone in a basket, and you know, like, let's say you're at somebody's house, and the first person to reach for his phone has to do the dishes. Or the first person who reaches for his phone has to pay the check when the bill comes. Oh, well. So those are my thoughts.
But then the watches are there too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and these are gadgets. I think things are heading toward wearables, or even subcutaneous, whatever form that might take. Imagine if your thumb and forefinger on your right hand, are you a right hand or a left hand person? If you're a right hand person. So imagine a little subcutaneous gizmo that you don't even feel in the tip of your finger, your index finger, and then another one on the tip of your thumb. And imagine how, with the kind of technology that's coming, I'm sure it's going to be here soon, you wouldn't even need a phone or a watch. All you'd have to do would be to press those two together a certain way. And then, like, if you were going to, you know, widen a picture on a screen, you just move them apart and there's like a holographic screen there now.
Where am I supposed to get it?
In the future. It's not available yet. But I think it's coming.
It's coming.
Yeah. So we'll look back on iPhones and Apple Watches or iWatches, whatever they're called. We're going to look back on those in the not too distant future, Georgia, the way I look back on things like 8-track tapes and record players and vacuum tubes for televisions. It's like so hokey and so primitive and so clunky. And like, how did we even get along with those primitive things? I think we're going to look back on the high-tech gadgets we have now with a similar view, like, oh my gosh, all they had was an iPhone and they had to carry that thing.
That is so 2022. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're going to live to see a lot more of it than I will, Georgia, if you're 20 years old. So
I hope
when I'm in heaven, you know, say a prayer and just say, hey, Patrick, here's what's going on down here.
And
don't forget to pray
for
me.
Yeah.
An 8-track to you is an iPod to her.
There you go. That's a good... Do you even know what an iPod is, Georgia?
I had an iPod.
Did you? Okay. Yeah, I don't remember when. Those were probably, about 10 years ago, I guess. But...
I think more than 10.
Probably. I have one kicking around in a drawer somewhere in my office. Here's a final thought, Georgia. I think you'll find this interesting. My oldest son is turning 41 in a couple of months, and my youngest son is 21. So there's a space of... roughly 20 years between my oldest and youngest, spread across 11 kids. About, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, I got a picture off the internet of an insert, a little plastic insert that goes inside of the center of a 45 record. So the 45s were the smaller records, so you'd have one song on each side. And then the LP was much bigger. It didn't have to have an insert because the rod in the center of the phonograph. And I realize I'm talking like an ancient language now to you, but in the center of the phone. You know, okay. So you've studied archaeology. You know about these ancient artifacts. I showed all of my kids. We were all together for some family thing. And I showed them, all it was just a picture of the plastic. It's a round plastic insert that goes in the middle of the record, but you don't see anything else but this insert. And I asked them to identify it. None of them could identify what that was. And for me, that was so amazing because I realized what a huge cultural gulf exists now in terms of pop culture between what to me was just like, you know, like soda or hot dogs or, I mean, it was so common when I was young and it was absolutely foreign and indecipherable to them. And I think we're going to see even bigger jumps going forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome, Georgia. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to wax eloquent on such matters. And thanks for listening.
Have a good rest of your day.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for listening. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, I know you could have identified the 45 record insert, but isn't it weird that somebody who's now in his 40s was not able to identify that? That's just weird.
Yeah, that's a little weird. I wonder if that wax joke went over her head or not.
Probably did.
Pretty good.
That's almost ingenious right there.
That's what I thought. Thank you. Let's go to David, waiting patiently in Gig Harbor, Washington. Hello, David.
Hey, good morning, Patrick.
Hi.
Hey, Chris, I came across John 3:16 this morning on Facebook. I belong to a Catholic Facebook group.
Oh, great.
And a word caught my... What's that?
I said, oh, great.
Okay. And so it says, God so loved the world that he gave his only son, so everyone who believed in him might have eternal life. And the word might caught my attention. I was wondering about that.
Yeah. It's a function of the translation.
Okay.
So let's look at it in the Revised Standard Version, Catholic Edition. There it says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. So that's the Revised Standard Version. Now let's take a look at it in the New American Bible, which is the one that we hear at Mass. John 3:16 mm-hmm. there says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son so that everyone who believes in him might not perish, but might have eternal life. There's a distinction between how it's translated. So the words the words could be translated either way, but I understand the nuance that you're getting at, and that is it introduces an element of doubt. And that's true because not everybody will be saved. So here's how I would propose that you... Yeah, so here's how I would propose that you look at it. In other words, this is a free gift. God so loved the world that he's giving this gift of himself in and through his son, Jesus Christ, to the whole world. This is for everybody. So everybody has an opportunity for this. But the might is a way of suggesting, or we can infer from that, that even though this is a universal gift for all people, not all people are going to accept it. Therefore, not all people are going to be saved. But for those who do accept it, they will be saved, all other things being equal, like dying in the state of grace. But the might, I think, is a way of showing in this statement that not everybody is going to make use of this. Not everybody is going to cooperate with it. You see what I mean?
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, good. Did we get it, or is there anything left?
No, you got it, Patrick, like always. So.
Well, thank you. Appreciate your confidence, David, and thanks for listening. Let's go quickly to Karen in Visalia, California, that is. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. Just want to say that Relevant Radio has changed my life, and I am so impressed with your command of the English language and how you're able to handle all the different types of people with their questions and their attitude. It's just so elegant, but you have brought so much to my life. Thank you.
Thank
my question would be is, my question would be is, if a person would die, and is there a possibility of getting stuck? In other words, the person doesn't go to hell, they don't go to purgatory or heaven, and they're stuck. Is there a possibility?
I think so. And the reason I say that is that at the particular judgment, it's appointed to a man to die once, and then the judgment, there will be one of two final destinations, heaven or hell. But the interim destination for those on their way to heaven who need purification, we know that is purgatory. But what form will that take? Is it necessarily something that will be in this place that we think of as purgatory? Or is it possible that in the case of some souls that the Lord might permit them to experience purgatory in a somewhat different way? Or could it be that people who are indeed in purgatory are at the same time permitted by God to sort of manifest in a house or in a room or in some way as a way to maybe ask for prayers? I think that's entirely possible. So maybe that combination of both and might be how we could explain that if somebody seems like they're stuck. Maybe they're in purgatory, but they're stuck as far as we can see because they're still asking for prayer. I have to go, but what do you think about that, Karen?
Well, my sister has been taunted by my blood father for 90.
That is a big topic. Stand by and I'll come right back to you right after this.